You're listening to New England Public Radio News. I'm Adam Frenier, and this is the shortlist, NEPR's Week in Review. Joining us today, Matt Szafranski, editor of Western Mass Politics and Insight, and Rick Hurst, publisher of An African American Point of View. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Good to be here.
A poll released this week shows Massachusetts residents are against the idea of lowering the voting age in national and local elections. The margin was especially strong for federal contests. Western New England University pollster Tim Versalotti says respondents listed several reasons for their opposition.
51% said they're just not mature enough to vote at 16 and 17. And then 22% said they don't have enough knowledge about candidates and issues at that age.
There was a bit more support for allowing young people to vote in municipal elections. Matt, there's been some discussion in Massachusetts and even nationally on lowering the voting age. Are you surprised by the strength of the opposition?
Not exactly, because I think that to a certain extent, a lot of people have a serious question, like, is this really going to achieve its stated goal, which is frankly to get more young people to vote? And on a sheer numerical basis, it would, because more people would be eligible. But are really more younger people going to be interested in voting? And I think really the energy might be better addressed toward making sure young people understand why it's important to vote rather than simply letting more of them vote.
Rick, those surveyed did favor civic engagement by young people, things like walkouts over climate change and community service requirements to graduate high school. To kind of pick up on Matt's point, could those things help lead to more people wanting to vote when they become of age?
I'm not certain they'll lead to more people wanting to vote when they come of age, because not a lot of people vote now. And I think that if young people were given the right to vote, probably fewer of them would vote than even the 10% that comes out in Springfield. On the other hand, I have mixed feelings about the whole thing, because all those people who voted for Donald Trump and who are still intended to vote for him, I don't think they were so smart or so knowledgeable. I don't think a lot of voters are that educated who are above 16 and 17.
Moving on, a recent report to the State Gaming Commission shows the MGM Springfield Casino is down to 2,300 employees, about 700 fewer than when it opened last summer. Here's MGM Springfield head Mike Mathis.
You know, we're driving a bunch of overtime right now because we're a little bit understaffed. So there's a correlation between staffing and overtime. We're providing higher quality jobs, potentially not as many as we originally thought.
MGM promised it would have 3,000 employees at opening. The jobs figure after that was meant to be flexible, but Springfield's chief development officer says that number is the expectation. Rick, creating jobs is a big reason why there are even casinos in Massachusetts. Is MGM holding up its end of the bargain?
I think they're really holding up their end of the bargain. I mean, you got to consider the fact that they haven't made the money that they thought they would make. So there definitely was going to be some adjustment. Besides that, if they are in fact doing overtime, it's no surprise to me. Look at what's happening to Plainview in Boston. That new casino was pulling all their top people, their good people, away. And MGM is going to have that same kind of problem.
Matt, are city officials or even gambling regulators doing enough to hold MGM accountable on this?
Well, I think at the moment, from the city's perspective, the biggest concern is going to be what is the direct financial impact of the bottom line of the city. That's going to be, I think, their first concern. And nothing about this, whether the lower gaming numbers or the lower employment numbers, is going to have a direct impact on what they're paying out yet. I think the Gaming Commission wants to probably give them a little bit of space. And for that matter, I think you could say the same about city officials as well, to see whether or not they're meeting all of their obligations.
Staying in Springfield, the mayoral race is coming into focus, with up to four candidates who will look to knock off incumbent Dominic Sarno this fall. One of them is community organizer Yolanda Cancel. Her son is a recent victim of violent crime, but she says that's not her whole platform.
We can't just stay with crime, right? Because, you know, crime, a lot of the issues basically overlap with each other. Education, no jobs.
When asked this week about the upcoming election, Mayor Dominic Sarno declined comment. Matt, it's a big field running against Sarno, including an arts contributor to your website, Linda O'Connell. But can one of these candidates actually beat the longtime mayor?
Well, I think we're going to see that come into focus in the next month or two. I mean, whether or not the candidates are able to raise some of that, you know, I guess you could call it seed capital for a race. Normally, these kinds of things would happen several months ago. So if they're able to run that more in a more accelerated version of a traditional set up for a campaign, we might be able to, and then of course the preliminary will tell us a lot as well, we might have a better sense of how serious a challenge the mayor has this year.
And speaking of money, Rick, here's the $99,000 question. How difficult will it be for a challenger to overcome a well-financed incumbent who had exactly that amount of money in his campaign account, according to the latest reports to the state? That was as of May 15.
To be frank with you, at this point in the game, it's probably not possible. I'm glad that people are running against him because I think it'll teach him a little humility. But the folks took a long time to jump into the race. If you're going to beat an incumbent mayor, you got to give yourself at least a year and a half, and you got to have the money before the summertime.
And finally this week, the Connecticut House passed legislation which would require high schools to teach African American and Latino history to their students. The bill, which moves on now to the state Senate in Connecticut, is a pared-down version of a proposal which would have made this a graduation requirement. Rick, do other states need to look at requiring schools to offer similar courses?
That came up in the 60s and 70s. I thought everybody had been educated on that point. I'm surprised that Connecticut is so far behind and they're just figuring out what to do, and they only want to do it in the high school. I thought that our textbooks had been revised from kindergarten or pre-kindergarten on up, and that there might by this time not be a need for a special class in Black history or Latino history. We're way behind on this in Connecticut. Probably Matt, Massachusetts, too, by the way.
Matt, what about this idea of legislators making curriculum decisions as opposed to school leaders? And there are some school leaders who are a little uncomfortable with that.
I think it's always a problem, and you've seen this happen to a certain extent in conservative states. I mean, I do think that this is an important issue that I think that schools should be teaching. I'd go a step further and say they should also be looking at it in a global sense. Why aren't we having it? You know, we should, of course, talk about African American and Latino leaders in the United States. We should also be talking about, you know, what happened in Chile in the 70s and apartheid in South Africa. That being said, it might not always be the best thing for legislators to be stepping in with hard requirements. There should be other incentives and encouragement, maybe a broader set of values that educators are expected to follow.
All right, Matt Szafranski of Western Mass Politics and Insight and Rick Hurst of an African American Point of View, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you, our loyal listeners of The Shortlist, NEPR's Week in Review. And remember, you can catch us at any time wherever you get your podcasts or at nepr.net/podcast hub. I'm Adam Frenier, and this is New England Public Radio.